Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. This morning, we're looking for your questions on home maintenance, something we do every month on the show, always on a Monday. And our guest is Scott Spies from the Spies Home Inspection Service. If you have questions about heating and cooling, doors and windows, siding, windows, insulation, I said windows twice, didn't I? Basements, attics, any and all of those things that go into the single-family home. If you have some problem around your house and you're not quite sure how to deal with it, call in, tell us about it, and Scott will do his best to suggest a solution. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455. Thanks very much for being here.
Well, thank you, David. Always a good time to come out here and chit-chat with everybody.
Something I've been thinking about, because this winter we have had some days that are unusually warm. I'm thinking, and when, for this time of year, the humidity level gets up rather high, at least higher than you would expect it to be in January. I'm thinking that there might be some people who, because it's warm enough in their homes, that their furnace isn't running quite as much, humidity levels are higher, you're not getting the air movement that you do when the furnace is going and pumping in warmer, drier air. And I'm wondering whether there might in fact be some people who might be having some issues with mildew maybe or other dampness kind of things that they wouldn't ordinarily be thinking about or having in January.
Well, a very good point and a very real situation. Matter of fact, one of the houses I inspected last week, I got up in the attic, and the entire north side of the attic roof sheathing was literally dripping wet with moisture. And it is due to high humidities and the temperatures dropping in the evenings and things like that. Mm-hmm. I guess a good rule of thumb would be when you wake up in the morning, if you look at the windows and there's a little bit of condensation at the bottom edges of the window or something, the humidity level's high enough in the house, you could have condensation somewhere else in the house, usually in the cold spots. Turn the bathroom fan on, let it run for a half an hour or so. Bring some air through the house. Get some of that humidity back out of the house. Mm-hmm. Or find the moisture source. Figure out, okay, why are we getting this water in the house? Where is it coming from? Yes, there's quite a bit of moisture in the air outside, but usually there's also sources indoors. Cooking and cleaning and showering and things like that. Dampness in a crawl space. Usually when we get a good cold quick good quick cold snap. Mm-hmm. One of the major things I find is that the power humidifier does not get set down. So it gets ends up getting set at high enough to humidify when it's 30 degrees. Well, we got these days that we're coming in at 10 and 15 degrees. So we're adding about twice as much moisture into the house as what the house really wants. So we have this condensation problem. And it can be a mold and mildew issue. As we build our houses tighter and tighter with better building materials, better insulation, house wrap, etc., we do have a more of a moisture issue to get out of the house.
Mm-hmm. And just to hang in for a second to talk about humidification, some people feel the need, I guess particularly in the wintertime, to put more moisture into the home atmosphere. If, though, your house is reasonably tight and you do what most people do, you cook, you take showers, you do laundry, should you really need humidification?
Probably not. Most of the time, if you think you need more humidity in the house, what you really need to do is go around with a caulking gun and seal things up and find your air leaks and figure out where the moisture is going to. Most of our new construction, even though they're putting in a lot of humidifiers when they put in new furnaces, really they'd rarely, if ever, turn on because of the tight construction and the normal moisture that you would put in just living in the house.
Mm. Well, we have some callers here, and lines are full, in fact, so we will go to it and start to talk with folks here. Someone first in Charleston, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I have a question.
Sure.
It's like I'm working on a real old house, like 100 years old, and there was no insulation in the exterior walls. And is it normal for the wood to be dark? Is that like mold?
No, it's probably not mold. An older home like that, the wood as it ages does tend to turn dark. I assume you're talking about wood inside the walls?
It's like inside the exterior walls. It's real dark. It's like almost like black, and I didn't know if it was black mold or what.
No,
part of the plaster was dark, you know, the lath, because like there's no vapor barrier or no insulation or nothing in the walls, and they took the plaster off, and some of the plaster was black in color.
Yeah, like I say, in those older houses, I mean, when you're looking 100 years old plus, it is very common to find a lot of a black dust. Near as I can tell, I can attribute it to back when the house was heated with coal, and there was a lot of coal dust because they brought the coal in, and we had the coal-fired furnaces. The coal and the oil both burned very black. So, yes, I found them when tearing off roof sheathing in old wood shingles and stuff, a lot of this black, sooty, oily-based stuff. I have never really found much in the way of mold and mildew, most of the time because the house has no insulation. We're moving a lot of air through the house. The older houses really dry out too much. Those are the ones we need power humidifiers and such in there. So I doubt very much that it's actually a mold or mildew. My guess is it's a coal dust or an oily residue from an old oil furnace or something like that.
So that's why that wood would be kind of real, almost black in color on the, as you tear into the exterior walls from the inside. You know, you take the plaster off and the lath off and it's real dark. It's almost black. It's not mold then.
I would say it's probably not. Generally, on a loose house like that, we don't have a moisture problem that'll create the humidity that the mold and mildew would grow on, unless there was a roof leak or something like that. But my guess is you're going to find this throughout the house, not in just one or two areas like we had a leak. And it's usually just a dust and dirt. Now, the only way to tell it is to actually do an air sample and do an air test. But my experience would say that that is not a mold or mildew.
Oh, okay. All right, thanks.
All right, thank you. Let's go to the next caller, Champagne, line two. Hello.
Yes, I was going to put in a radon mitigation system in myself, and I know the law changed on January the 1st, and I wonder, do you have to be a licensed radon mitigator to install a system, or as long as the radon level is below the 4.0, you're okay when it comes time to sell the house?
Okay, I'm quite honest in saying I'm not familiar with the new law. I knew that they did change some laws, but I'm not sure what they've actually gone to at this point in time. It's something I'm going to have to do some research on. As far as I know, from what I've had in the past, I actually used to be licensed to do radon mitigation back when radon first became an issue back in the 90s or late 80s. As far as I know, yes, you are allowed to put it in yourself. There is no requirement that you be certified to do something. And so as long as you can put in the system and get it vented to an acceptable area, generally speaking, you have to either vent it 2 feet above the roof or 10 feet out from the nearest wall. Mm-hmm. As long as you vent it in the proper area, then yes, it is an acceptable way of doing it.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right. Well, thank you. Let's continue. And our next caller is on a cell phone, line number four. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I recently purchased a metal roof. I've not installed it yet. I've had various. I've investigated how to install it. I wanted to install it above my existing shingles. However, there's all kinds of involvement in order to do that. I know I need to leave a 1-inch air space that will let air movement go up through and between rafters and exit the ridge vent. Mm-hmm. I recently got fed up with my plumber contractor who was going to help me with the roof and decided to bring in an actual roofing specialist, and he said he didn't want to have anything to do with it because he didn't want to install the roofing above shingles. He thought that was, while it was done a lot, it was not according to code, and he wasn't going to get involved doing that. Now I'm back to square one, wondering whether or not I should just strip the roof to begin with and start over, or whether I should continue as I wanted to put the roof over the top of the shingles. Of course, leaving what I was going to do is crisscross. Members have some going horizontally and then some going vertically over the top of them. so that I would have that ventilation necessary to. You can't get rid of the condensation, but you can eliminate it once it's there or mitigate it.
Well, both Champaign and Urbana do have some local codes prohibiting the number of layers of asphalt shingles put on a house, so that you can't just stack layer upon layer. You do have a weight factor. The roof, we call it snow load in this area, but basically the roof load, how much weight it can hold, is dependent quite a bit on the framing sizes and how many layers of asphalt shingles you've got. Now, you're talking about putting a steel roof over the top of it. The steel roof is much lighter than what the asphalt shingles are. So I'm not sure how sticky our code guys are going to be about putting an overlay over the top of that with a steel roof. But you are very correct in that you must provide ventilation for the steel roof, because it does get cold and it does create condensation problems. You got to have very good ventilation for the attic, things like that, to keep that moisture condensation from creating a problem. For a little while there, back in the late 50s, we actually had some all-side houses that were all-steel houses. And they actually had a gutter running inside the attic to collect the condensation that was running down the steel and collect it and drain it to the outside. Hopefully you don't have that kind of a moisture problem for what you're doing. Like I say, the steel roof really isn't all that heavy per square foot relative to the asphalt shingles. If you've got two or more layers of asphalt shingles on there, yes, I would go ahead and do the strip. Otherwise, it tends to hold heat, particularly after the sun hits that steel siding or steel roofing, and it starts basically baking the asphalt, holding a lot of heat there, can create some other problems. If you've only got one layer on there, then I don't see any reason why you couldn't go over the top of that with your steel. Just make sure you get a good way of ventilating it, get your purlins in there, something to nail it to that allows the air penetration.
Well, I do only have one, and not only that, but my attic ventilation is a little suspect as well. So if I could get that ventilation above the roof decking, I would feel a little more comfortable with it myself. So maybe that is what I will do. And that way, perhaps I won't need quite as much of the ventilation down inside the attic itself, where I know I'm going to need some, and I'm providing for as much as I can, but there are mitigating factors that prevent me from, this is older construction and I'm redoing it, and there are problems I have with supplying attic insulation, ventilation. So having the ventilation on top is going to help me an awful lot. I too live out in the country, so I don't have codes to worry about, but I do also realize that codes are there for a reason, and if the underlying reason is reason enough to have a code, it's also reason enough not to do it that way.
Yeah.
In most cases.
Well, definitely you have to worry about your weight loads, and because we do have the snowfall and the wind loads and things like that. Mm-hmm. I would say the ventilation underneath your steel roofing is a good idea, but it's still not a substitute for ventilation for the attic. So you still want to do some provisions for ventilation in that attic. Mm-hmm. Because you've got the steel roof on there and the steel is one area is going to condense, doesn't mean we can't get condensation on the wood framing if we don't have enough attic ventilation. So definitely do not avoid your attic ventilation just because you're putting ventilation underneath the steel.
Now, I was told too that by putting 30-pound roofing felt over the top of the existing shingles, that I was actually trapping moisture in my attic.
30-pound roofing felt can be considered as a vapor barrier, yes. So you could actually do something like that. It would end up as being a vapor barrier, depending on how well you had it lapped. But, tar papers and roofing felt papers and such have enough of an oil base to them that they can be considered a vapor barrier.
So But as long as I have adequate ventilation in the attic, it shouldn't make a difference anyway.
That is correct.
Okay.
All right.
Well, I think I'm doing pretty well in that regard. It's not perfect. It's not as good as it would be if I had, was able to start over, but it should be pretty close to it.
And the steel roof gives a nice long-term surface, so you shouldn't have to do it again for many, many years down the road. So.
Right. Well, thanks for the call. I want to, just for anybody who might have tuned in, introduce again the guest for this hour of Focus, Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Home Inspection Service and is here on a Monday once a month to answer these kind of questions, and we'll do as many as we can. If you have some kind of repair or maintenance issue and you need to get some advice, 333-9455. Toll free 800-222-9455. And next we'll talk with someone in Urbana. Line number 3.
Hi, thanks. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I have a really, really long dryer vent, and I think it needs to be cleaned out. Do you know anybody who does that?
Oh, there's several handymen that can do things like that, and they make brush kits and such that are sold at the local do-it-yourself stores. Usually, if somebody's got a long vent, I like to recommend that rather than use the flexible plastic duct, the sort of the accordion type stuff, and install a smooth metal duct. The metal duct will keep from blocking up quite as quickly with the lint. The accordion styles usually kind of acts as a little muffler and kind of slows the air down and traps a little bit more lint in there. But yeah, there are several handymen that can come out and do that. Just general contractors. You don't really need a specialist for duct cleaning. And like I say, they do make the brush kits. I've seen them available at the.
Well, I couldn't handle that. I'd need somebody to do it for me. Mm-hmm. What would you look under in the Yellow Pages? Is it just?
Well, I'll tell you what, if you want to give a call over to our office, my father has a fairly good list of people that he uses for things like that, so he'd be more than happy to share some names.
Great. Thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. All right. Thank you. Champagne is next. This is line number 1. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I've recently moved into a 40s vintage house in the west side of Champaign that has the leakiest windows imaginable. And Thursday night when it was 2 below zero, I was sitting near one of them, and I could feel this cascade of cold air coming out. They're what you'd expect of the vintage, sash pockets and sash weights and the whole nine yards. And mm-hmm. So obviously I want to replace them, but I want to find out varying systems for replacing the windows and how to find a proper contractor that would know how to properly install them and doing replacement windows versus perhaps, my first inclination is to rip the whole things out all the way back to the rough opening and then replace it with from that point. But I can see that could be a bit of a problem and awfully expensive and involve messing up a lot of the interior woodwork. So I'm wanting to learn about differing systems and what you could recommend to me or assist me with along those lines.
Okay, well, there's a number of articles that are available. Again, we've got some lists that we could you could call us and we can get to you that would give you some ideas on how to rework or rebuild the windows.
Mm-hmm.
Generally speaking, windows of that area were actually a pretty good quality window.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, because of the designs with the weight ropes alongside the jams, there are a lot of areas for air leakage. They do make some kits where you can remove the weight ropes and fill the boxes with insulation and then put either a wound spring up at the roller at the top that you could hook to the window, and it's basically a flat wound spring that replaces the lift rope and the lift weight, so you can get more insulation in there. There's also some spring-loaded pressure weather strips where you can actually take the stop trim off the window, take the two windows out, put this plastic, it's got plastic and foam combination deal where it can be compressed, and you put the windows in it and slide it back in and re-nail the new tracks, which then give you a side friction, which will also provide a little bit more weather stripping.
I would like to, I think, though, thinking long term, probably look into replacing them and getting, modern low-E glass and that kind of thing in. The house I had before, I'd replaced the windows with flowy glass and so forth. And believe me, it was, that house was a whole lot warmer than this one is, and seemed to use about a fraction as much energy and so on and so forth. So I'm probably wanting to look in the direction of the replacement.
Well, you'd be surprised at reworking the windows you've got, and a good set of storm windows may not be all that far off the energy efficient of some of these newer windows.
Okay.
Yes, the low E glass does have as far as the glass itself does have a little better R value. Actually, one of the benefits is the fact that it filters enough UV light out that you tend to get better or longer life on furniture and carpet. We don't get color fade and things like that. Mm-hmm. So there are definitely pros and cons. The new windows, you probably can go ahead and not have to take it all the way back down to the rough opening and put in new construction windows. You can use the existing sills and jams and put in replacement windows. Mm-hmm. But you probably will have to take the trim off around the windows and insulate the weight boxes and such.
Right. Okay, well, I'll give you a call at the shop and get that data.
Yeah, because we've got the Journal of Light Construction had several articles on how to rebuild windows, how to replace windows, things like that, and we've handed those out with our reports. And so we've got a couple of the more exciting articles, ones that actually look like they're getting something done. We've got those on file so that we can give you references on how to find them.
Would your firm be interested in actually just coming to the house and doing an audit, looking over our windows, and then coming up with a report, perhaps, and a list of contractors and so forth?
As a general rule, I don't put my list of contractors in writing. It's more of
right.
a recommendation.
Right.
But yes, we do quite often do what I'll say an energy audit. We go through a house and look for any sources that could be a major air leak or any improvements that could be douse, and kind of give you an order of, okay, what should I do next?
Right.
And our company and several others will do that type of thing to kind of give you a guidance where you can...
I think that'd be the way to go.
Okay.
All right, thank you.
Right, thank you.
Thank you. We'll keep on here. And the next person we'll talk with is also in Champaign. This is line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, quick question about whole house humidifiers. The excess water running from that currently goes into a sump pump and then shoots out 10 feet away from the house.
Mm-hmm.
Is it legal in the city of Champaign to reroute that excess water into the sewage system?
For the power humidifier, yes, it is. For the sump pump, no, it's not.
No,
in other words, you'd have to redo where your pump is. Either run it as a gravity drain to a regular drain or use a condensate pump. But, yes, the runoff from the power humidifier can be run into sanitary.
And that's the same for air conditioning, right?
Yes, it is. You are required to have an air gap between the hose. In other words, you can't pipe it direct. It's got to drip into something that's got an air gap and then has a trap to it. You can't just run the pipe to a PVC drain and glue it in. It's got to have an air break or a vacuum break to it.
Okay. Great. Thank you very much.
All right.
All right. Thank you. Over to Lafayette. Line number 4. Hello.
Hello.
Mm-hmm.
Do you recommend shutting off water and water heaters in houses or buildings left unoccupied in winter?
Well, it's never a bad idea to shut the water valve to the off position if you're going to not be there. That way, if something were to go wrong with the heating system, if we did end up freezing some water lines somewhere in the house, at least we aren't going to do more than drain whatever's already in the lines and not necessarily keep pumping water in. So, I have a rental unit that occasionally ends up vacant this time of year, and the first thing I do is go over there and turn the water valve off down in the basement. I, generally speaking, don't drain everything because I do plan on leaving the heat and such on. But as a precaution, I do turn the water off. Now, if you're going to not use it at all, if let's say you're one of these people that like to head to Florida for the winter months, then it's not a bad idea to turn it off and then winterize the house, or at least do, at a minimum, drain most of the drain lines out so that you don't have water in there. Again, as a precaution, because you don't know. Somebody may have a problem down the block where they shut the gas off, and so all your pilot lights end up going out, things like that.
Okay. I wanted to ask you, are programmable thermostats safe to install by a regular owner? I'm thinking of the electrical connections. I suppose they're low voltage. Many specify 24 volts in the system. But is there some danger of if you connect to the wrong contact on the thermostat?
Well, the only thing that's going to really happen if you do that is probably blow the thermostat itself.
Yeah.
Yes, it is a 24-volt AC, low-voltage system. The transformer is usually mounted somewhere near the furnace. And generally, if you want to do it with power off, most of the time that transformer is connected to the same power source as the furnace. So if you turn the switch or breaker off for the furnace, usually it'll turn the power supply off for the thermostat. Not always, depends on who wired up what. But it is a low enough voltage where you'd have to really work hard to get a good spark or anything like that out of it, so it's generally safe to work with.
Is 24 volts standard from these, in these systems?
Yeah, it is. They basically use the same transformer, whether you're looking at a thermostat or your doorbell. So just about everything in the house is low voltage, which those are pretty much it. The furnace controls, the air conditioner controls, and the doorbell are your low voltage circuits in the house, and they are a 24-volt AC.
Okay. What about my own routine? I live alone. I'm not on any fixed hours. Do I do just as well by dialing the thermostat down myself in the evening and up again in the morning?
Well, if you don't have any fixed hours to where you're in and out and things need to change, then the programmable isn't quite as convenient. The nice part about the programmable one is you can set it for a regular regimen, whether you're going to be gone 8 to 5, 5 days a week, mm-hmm. Or whatever your hours are going to be. I don't usually recommend setting them too far up or too far down, depending on the season.
No, I think I've heard you say something like 10 degrees.
10 degrees would be excessive.
Yep.
I probably would not go that far. You're going to end up using almost as much energy trying to bring the house back up, because once all the furniture and the carpeting and everything else, all the mass of the house cools down that far, the furnace is going to have to work quite a bit to come back up, and your comfort level is not going to be good as comfortable until after you get everything heated back up in the house. Usually for heating, 6 to 8 is about the top. For cooling, I only like to see about 3 or 4, because you end up letting all the humidity back in the house, and then the air conditioner has to run twice as long to get the moisture back out.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right, thanks. So you think your programmable thermostats are good?
They can be for some people. It kind of depends on how your schedule is. If you've got somebody that's at home on a regular basis, there's not a whole lot of reason to have the programmable. But if you've got one or two people in the house and they're gone literally 8 to 5, 5 days a week, there's no reason why you couldn't put one in to have it set the thermostat down, like say 6 degrees or 7 degrees at 8 o'clock in the morning, have it come back up around 4:30, 5 o'clock to bring the house back up to temperature. Depending on how well insulated the house is, how far down that temperature will actually drop. Mm-hmm. If you have a good insulated house, it may not drop full 6 to 8 degrees unless we have really cold weather. I mean, if we've got, you know, 30 or 35 degree weather outside, the house may never drop the full amount.
Yeah, and it's something where I think most people would not do this themselves. If you're going to hire an electrician to do that, it's not a particularly complicated thing to do.
Actually, a thermostat is 4 wires, so generally speaking, they're quite easy.
All right. Our guest this morning in this part of the show is Scott Spies, and if you have questions on home maintenance, give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And our next caller is in Urbana, line 1. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a 2-story house. It has a gable roof, and the front faces east and the back faces west. And in the attic, the joists on the front east side of the house run east and west. And on the back half of the house, the joists run north and south.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in the ceiling on the second floor, there's a crack along that line of where these two different kinds of joists meet. And there's two doorways that are in an east-west wall where the doors don't fit into the door frames anymore. The door frames look square, but I had to plane off the tops of two of those doors, and they're quite crooked. So I guess I want to know why they got so crooked and what to do about that crack. Is there something that should be done to pull that whatever it is that's holding it, pull that together again so the cracks aren't there and the crooked doors aren't there.
Okay. How old is the house?
80 years old.
Okay. Chances are pretty good you're not going to get rid of the crack. When you have a change in roof framing like that, you also change how the wood expands and contracts from humidity and temperature changes. As the wood warms up, it expands. When it cools down, it contracts, basically, because as it warms up, it picks up a little bit of moisture, and when it cools down, it loses some moisture. So there is some movement when you've got the roof framing going in 90-degree directions. You are going to get some differential movement.
This is the floor joist. The floor joists that are
But this crack is in the ceiling?
Crack is in the ceiling of the second floor.
Yeah, so most likely what you've got is some change in framing up in the attic area as well. Because usually if they've changed the direction of the floor joist, it was either an addition. No, it's not addition, all original.
No, it was originally built that way. That's what I'm wondering, why was it ever built that way?
Oh, there's any number of different ways of or any reasons for them to do it at that point in time, depending on where they want their load-bearing walls, how far apart or what the partitions are in the basement or the first floor. In order to get enough span, sometimes they have to change the directions of the floor framing. Just out of curiosity, any idea if those doors that are going out of square are anywhere near the chimney?
The wall is along the chimney. This division is along one side of the chimney.
Okay, what's happening is that some of the framing has been attached to the masonry chimney, and the chimney being brick or masonry does not expand and contract the same rate as the wood, and so your whole house, the wood framing of the house, kind of moves up and down around this chimney, and this chimney is then your high spot. It's fairly common in houses of that age that they would actually pocket some of the joists and such into the masonry framing, and when it does create when they do it that way, it does create a problem with the floors not wanting to be level, because now you've got this high spot in the middle of the house because everything is attached to that brick chimney, which doesn't shrink or quote-unquote settle with the rest of it.
There's one north-south joist that goes right along the east side of the chimney.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as soon as you told me you had some doors that were way out of square at the top, it pretty much gave me the hint that somebody's framed that to the chimney. Really, there's no good cure for it short of pulling the door frame loose and resetting the door frame.
Yeah. Well, the door frames look square. That's the ironic part.
Well, they may look square, but my guess is either the hinge or the jamb side is moved up or down, which is what's let everything go out of whack for you.
Oh, okay. Okay, so that could move up and down and still look square.
Yeah. Well, it'll kind of make it a trapezoid, but it won't look completely off. The only way the door would go out of... It would not fit as if and the top of it still be square would be if the bottom were to move in or out and the door would actually have to be tweaked in the opening. I doubt that's what's happening. Most likely what we've got is a high spot where that chimney is and the rest of the house settled or shrank as it aged and has dropped just enough that it's created your door bind. Planing the top of the door is one way to get it to work for now. To get it, the permanent fix would be to remove the door from the rough opening and reshim the door square and put it back in.
Reshim the doorway or the door?
The whole doorway, the whole frame.
Doorway and everything, huh?
Yeah.
So is there any, I guess I'm worried about the future. Is there any way this is going to get worse and worse and worse so that somewhere down the line somebody will say, well, you should have done something way back then?
Probably not. It's the style of construction, the way it was built, the lumber as it shrinks, as it ages. It's going to move slowly, but not rapidly. I don't think brick doesn't do anything quickly, and wood, once it's that old, is almost as hard as the brick, once it ages that far. So I doubt that very much that you've got any, what I'll call structural problems. I mean, obviously without seeing it and being able to eyeball it and determine what's going on. This is a kind of a guess over the radio, but I really doubt that you have any significant structural issues.
Okay. Well, do you think having a roof replaced and all the noise and work and all the whatever pounding and nailing on the roof would cause some of that crack? Would usually that be part of it?
Usually if the crack is a one long line, then that's usually not the issue. The workmanship and stuff probably didn't disturb it. It is possible, as when you have an older house like that with plaster ceilings and plaster walls, the plaster is put over the top of a wood or a screen lath. Probably with an 80-year-old house, you're probably looking at a wood lath.
It's wood lath.
And that plaster, as it gets older, does get more brittle. And so when you do things like change the load on the roof, removing roofing, adding more layers of roofing, changing things around, we get enough shift, you can break the plaster keys loose and start ending up with plaster ceilings and plaster walls that are starting to crack and pull loose. But those usually do not go in one straight line. Usually, if it's a straight line, it's an attic framing issue. Usually plaster that's coming loose from broken keys works more in a circular pattern.
Yep, I have some of that too.
Okay.
Yeah, about everything.
Well, with a house that old, it's been around for a while. It's due to have a few things like that.
Okay, well, at least you don't think it's going to get worse and worse and worse.
It doesn't sound like it's going to fall down on top of you, no.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. We'll keep on going here. Next is someone in Savoy, and it's line number 2. Hello?
Hello, I'd like to return to the thermostat question.
So
if the power goes out for 2 or 3 days and the house cools down and you have a gas furnace, is there any way to bypass the thermostat system and cause the gas to kick on?
No.
Is there any way to use 12-volt batteries in series to trigger the thermostat?
Well, see, the problem is if the thermostat kicks on, you turn on the gas valve, there's still no air moving through there, so you're not getting enough air to cool the heat exchanger down.
Through happenstance, the house that I'm thinking of, you can do okay that way for a day or two. I've lived through that 15 years ago.
I do remember the ice storm that we had 15 years ago that put power out. Matter of fact, my father's house was out for 7 days. I was out for, I think, 4. In Southwest Champaign was out for 2 hours. kind of how the power grid went. But as a general rule, no, you should not try and run the furnace with no power. Once the burner fires up in the end of the heat exchanger, particularly on the more efficient units, the air needs to be moving through that heat exchanger to cool it down. Otherwise, the heat exchanger will overheat and it can cause some stress cracks or fractures in there, and you end up with cracks or holes in the heat exchanger. The really newer units, the 78% and above efficiency units, actually use an induction fan to pull the combustion gases out of the house. And without 120 volts, those fans are not running, so we're not getting the flue gases out of the house. So running the furnace without a power source is not recommended.
Well, I'm told that this is an old warhorse gas furnace that was over-engineered.
Okay. Well, like I say, if the blower fan's not running, then the heat exchanger can overheat very easily. There is a high limit switch that is supposed to shut the furnace off if the temperature in the heat exchanger gets too high. But cycling it all the way to the high limit switch and then cooling it back down is a good way to stress or fatigue the metal in the heat exchanger.
Are those limit switches just, I forgot what they're called, heat expansion devices, or do they require electricity too?
No, there's both. There are some that require electricity, but most of the older ones are an expansion type.
Okay, thank you.
All right, next to line number 3 in Champaign. Hello.
Hello. I've got 2 bathrooms on a second floor with the exhaust ceiling exhaust fans. And both of those tubings go out, of course, into the attic and extend to the east side. I guess the idea it's a vent going from the west to the east. And they don't have any flappers or closures on them or anything. And I was kind of wondering how much heat we lose on something like that. The ceiling. We bought the house about 40 years ago, and it had either 4 or 6 inch insulation, bad insulation in it, and I added blown in, so it's got a lot of insulation, and you can't even see the joists. And it'd be another problem of getting to it to try to install flaps, but I wonder just if it's worth that or if there's a lot of heat loss involved in something like that.
Well, if there were no flap, then yes, there can be a fair amount of heat loss. You've got basically a 3-inch hole, and as the air in the house warms up, hot air rises, it goes up towards the attic, so you end up with a natural draft. Most fan units have a flap on the unit itself before you hook the hose up. There's a little metal flapper door, so when the fan's on, it opens up and it lets the air run out to the vent. Then a lot of the vents that have the fitting on the outside have a flapper door on the outside. Just because there's not a flapper on the outside does not mean you don't have a flapper in the system, because there's usually one built into the box for the fan light unit.
Right. Okay. Well, I should look into that. I think maybe it's a flashlight or something. I could see that.
Usually not, because it's up above the fan where it's not what you'd call in a visible area. It's something you'd almost have to disconnect the duct from the fan itself and see if it's there.
Right. Okay. Well, it's not worth trying to put a flapper on the outside then, probably.
Well, are you getting a lot of cold air coming down through it?
No, I can't feel it, really.
Well, then I think you're probably all right. It's probably closing off fairly well.
Well, as I said, the other problem is getting to it because...
Yeah. Well, the flappers on the outside or louvers on the outside are generally a good idea, but it's not only to block air, but also to reduce the chances of birds trying to nest in there. You get a little bit of warm air coming out of there, and they think it's a really nice place to live.
Oh, boy. Okay. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. We have about 6-7 minutes left in this part of Focus 580 with Scott Spies. He's a home inspector with the Spies Inspection Service, and he's here monthly on a Monday. We talk about home maintenance. If you got some kind of problem, just give us a call, and he'll see if he can help you out. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Maybe just since we were just talking about the vents from bathrooms, and maybe it's good to remind people to make sure that the vent from the bathroom does actually go to the outside, that it doesn't just vent into their attic, because that could be definitely creating some problems for yourself.
Well, it kind of depends on how much attic ventilation you've got. Yes, ideally the vent is to go outside. The current codes are requiring them to go to the outside. But I found an awful lot of times when you've got a really well-ventilated attic, as long as the vent is not blowing directly onto any of the wood framing and out into an open area, that moisture does dissipate fairly well. Of course, the tighter the house is, the more insulation we have in things, and that's probably not the best move. But in some of the older houses, I've found an awful lot of houses that are 60, 80 years old that have a bathroom vent fan going to the attic and doesn't go outside, and there's no indication of any problems. So as long as you've got good ventilation, but the tighter you make the house, there again, we have that little bit of moisture can make a big difference. So yes, they should go out, and the codes for the new houses are that they are required to go out. Mm. Attic ventilation is one of those things where I was reading the code on that the other day, and down at the bottom of the code, after they told us exactly how many square inches of free open area you had per square foot of attic space, it said, if deemed necessary. So,
by whom?
Well, by circumstances. If we got moisture, you need more ventilation. And it's one of those things where ventilation is, you can't really have too much of it until it starts leaking. If it's leaking, then you've probably got the wrong type of ventilation or too much of ventilation. But other than that, get about as much as you can. Your insulation in your ceiling is what's preventing the heat loss, and not how much you're blocking up the attic. It's absolutely amazing how many times I get up in attics doing inspections and find styrofoam blocks stuffed in all the roof vents and such, where they're, oh, we're saving all this heat that was going out. It's like, well, okay, but you're saving the heat after it's already passed through the insulation, so it's not actually affecting the house. Now what you're doing is you're trapping all that moisture and all that potential problems up in the attic area. So, yeah, attic ventilation is a good thing. The only time you get too much is if the water starts coming in.
Yeah, all right. Anything else, just general in terms of furnace, that things you could say about making sure that anything that you can do to make sure that it's going to operate its maximum efficiency? I suppose the big thing, the first thing you'd want to make sure is that you've got a clean filter in there.
The filter is a very important part of the system, because not only does it filter out the dust and such for the air that's blowing it back towards you, but also because if the filter blocks up, it starts reducing the amount of air moving across that heat exchanger. And again, the heat exchanger can overheat Also, the less air you move past the heat exchanger, the more air goes out through your flue system, because we're not taking that heat and transferring it into the house. So the more air that we can get through there, then the better off the system's going to run. So, yes, a clean filter is very important. If at some point in time somebody ran it without a filter, it's surprising how much dust, dirt, lint, and et cetera you can get on your air conditioner coil. So if you've got a system that seems to blow an awful lot of hot air instead of a little bit of cool air, or warm air, rather, anytime you've got warm air blowing, it's going to feel cool, but the temperature is up. If it's blowing really hot, that's usually an indication that we're not getting enough air through the heat exchanger, and the heat exchanger is getting too warm. While it may feel good on the toes coming out of the register, it's not the most efficient way to operate the system. A new filter, or even possibly getting somebody to come out and clean the air conditioner coil so that we're getting some air through the air coil as well. I've been in a lot of times, go through a basement and walk past a furnace and just feel the heat radiating off of the flue pipe. Well, that tells me that all that heat that's coming off that flue pipe is heat that did not get put into the house system. So I start looking for too many rooms dampered down, furniture placed over the top of registers, things like that. In order for that system to work efficiently, it's got to have good airflow. Without that airflow, most of that heat goes right up and out the chimney, which is not a cost-effective way of doing things.
Yeah, and you really you can't discount how much difference it can make you feel in how you have your dampers set. And depending, and that's in probably going to depend on what time of year it is and whether you're heating or cooling. I'll tell you a story about myself. Earlier this fall, when we started running the heat and we had some cold days, I was in my dining room, and I was just thinking about, well, the downstairs, it just feels really cold. Well, I realized I still had the dampers closed.
Yeah.
From where I had them set when we were having air conditioning. And I opened them up and I thought, gosh, it's a whole lot warmer in here. I just completely had not thought about it at all.
Balancing the heating and cooling system is a good way of saving some energy, because if you've got the house heating properly, you're more comfortable in the house, and the more comfortable you are, then the lower you can have that setting without having cold rooms. So a good balancing it will help with your energy use. You're quite correct. In the wintertime, obviously, we need to put most of the heat down low and let it rise up through the house. In the summertime, we put most of the cool air in high and let it fall down through the house. A lot of the new houses have furnaces upstairs and downstairs. Works quite well. Mm-hmm. But we get these great big two-story houses, 3,000-plus square feet, one furnace all the way down in the basement, and it's at the far end of the house. And the balancing makes all the difference in the world as to how comfortable the house is and how low you can set the thermostat and still have that perceived comfort in the house.
Yeah. We got a couple of minutes. When we have somebody calling, so we'll get them in. Is there anything in particular that you just think it'd be good for people to know or to think about this time of year?
Well, I've actually seen an awful lot of indications of condensation around or freezing around some of these direct vent furnaces. When we get these 0-degree days, you might want to take a walk around the house and take a look at that furnace stack and make sure that it hasn't blocked up with some ice. We usually don't have enough days where it's a real big problem. Very rarely do we have 5 or 6 days that are actually below zero to where we can start getting a lot of frost issues on the flue pipes. But I have seen some that get real close to being blocked with ice. So if you've got a high-efficiency direct vent furnace and it's cold for several days in a row, you might want to just kind of take a look at it and make sure that we haven't got a big ice buildup on there, which is blocking the flue pipe or blocking the intake.
Okay. We want to get at least one more caller here on our line number one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
This is me.
Yes.
Outstanding. Hey, I have a question about my roof, actually. Sorry for the change of subject.
That's fine.
My house is roughly L-shaped, so I've got the one valley where the two segments meet.
Mm-hmm.
And in that valley, you've got that one central, one piece of, I guess, long asphalt shingle in there, for lack of a better term.
Okay.
And it looks like it's sort of starting to deteriorate and part of it's flaking off.
Yeah, that is fairly common. It's what we'll call an open valley where they have a mineral roll roofing down the center of it. Because the valley is a lower pitch than the rest of the roof and it is a high concentration of water, it does tend to wear that valley anywhere from 3 to 5 years faster than the rest of the roof. Once that valley starts going, now ideally they've got a couple of different layers of protection underneath there, either a metal flashing or 2 or 3 layers of roofing felt, something underneath that, and it is supposed to be a double coverage, so if you were to poke a hole in the top of it, there is supposed to be another layer of roll roofing under it. But when I start seeing the cracking, mineral granule loss, where the tar paper or the even the asphalt base of the shingles is visible, I do recommend that you seal it or coat it with one of the roof coatings, either a blackjack or some type of roof sealant to help extend the life of that valley to meet the life of the rest of the shingles.
Okay, so like you said, it's deteriorating faster. The rest of the roof looks fine, so this is something that we could just sort of spot fix. We don't have to do any major, huge repairs there.
Yeah, it is very common for that type of a roof valley to wear out faster. So, yes, they do make some coatings that you can trowel on or smear on through the valley and seal it up. That usually gives you another 2 to 3 years.
Okay, sounds good. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Well, at that, I think we're going to have to finish up with our thanks to Scott Spies. He's here on the program every month, always on a Monday. We do these programs on home maintenance, so I guess we'll see you in February.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me over.